Our text again is 2 Samuel chapter 13 and verses 1 through 29. Title of the sermon is All in the Family. Perhaps the title appears or sounds familiar to you in that from 1971 to 1979, one of the most popular sitcoms on television was a program with the very same title. It was a commentary in some ways on this changing social strata of the day. You remember Archie Bunker and Edith, his wife, Rob Reiner, who was in the film often called Meathead by his father-in-law, and Gloria. Now, one of the striking features of this program was not only that it was a social commentary on changing America, but it also portrayed a highly dysfunctional family. And perhaps there were some who watched it for that very reason. The family, in many ways, was a mess, even though it stuck together. Dale Ralph Davis, who uses the very same title that I have, or perhaps I should say I've used his title, as the title to this sermon, writes of this chapter in its entirety, including a portion that we have not read but will next time. He says, our chapter is a mess. Amnon's unthinkable deed, an inexplicable change from lust to loathing, is at the very heart of the narrative. But dysfunction doesn't stop there. And dysfunction doesn't end there. It goes on to touch David and Absalom as well. And it brings destruction upon the home, the family, and multiple generations. Perhaps we could have entitled the sermon differently and entitled it Dysfunction, Not an Option. One thing leads to another. One sin leads to a second sin, and then it leads to sins in the next generation and so forth. David is being chastised, and we understand that and discover that from chapter 12 and verse 14, where we're told that that child will die and that further generations would feel the effect of that sin. David's house in verse 10, chapter 12 and verse 10, was shaped by Uriah's murder. And so one sin leads to another. We've noticed that before, but now it moves beyond David to his children. Gordon Keddy writes, no one ever fully anticipates the consequences of his mistakes. Our actions, like nuclear explosions, have a kind of fallout which may continue for some time and even impose permanent effects. In other words, we may never outlive some of them. And so David's sin leads to this sin that Absalom commits with his half-sister. And that event and subsequent events related to that, as one writer has said, dominate the latter part of David's reign and threaten to discredit him entirely. He almost loses his throne, together with any right to indicate which son should succeed him. Now, this has practical application for Christian homes, and it has applications even beyond that. One of the reminders of this text is that, as Matthew Henry wrote, godly parents have often been afflicted with wicked children. Grace does not run in the blood, but corruption does. And he went on to speak of this as a warning, in particular where there is parental bad example. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, modesty compels us to take great care in the way the text is told and retold. These are sensitive issues. They need to be stated, and at the same time, we hope to do so with a certain sense of modesty and restraint. One of the interesting things about the scriptures is that even when they deal with difficult subjects, they do so honestly. The Bible is perhaps the most honest book ever to be crafted. No subject of the scriptures is off limits, even if we are compelled to be cautious in the preaching of this text. As Matthew Henry writes, we have a particular account of the abominable wickedness of Amnon in ravishing his sister, a subject not fit to be enlarged upon, nor indeed to be mentioned without blushing. It doesn't say it shouldn't be mentioned. It just says that it ought not to be mentioned without blushing, that any man should be so vile, especially that a son of David should be so. And we want to look at the text then and notice the steps that are included, the consequence of one sin or the effects of one sin, sadly leading to another sin, which leads to a third sin, which leads to a fourth. Often, one sin leads to another, and it does so beyond the committing of a sin by one party, and that's what we find here. So there are several things that we want to notice in the text and seeking to make appropriate application from it. The first thing that we notice in verses 1 and 2 is the persistence of an unbridled passion. The persistence of an unbridled passion. Amnon is passionate about something, actually someone, and maintains a passion that was unlawful, unnatural, unbridled, and to a point, frustrated. One writer has said that to the effect that there is nothing really more contemporary than this particular text. This individual, in writing a volume of sermons on the text, said every tidbit of the classic love novel or television soap opera was in his heart. But we will hold Amnon in contempt and we'll feel deep pity for Tamar at the end of the story. Amnon's romantic tale was not true love. And so with that, we're introduced to two persons, half-brother, half-sister. Amnon was the son of David and Ahinoam of Jezreel. You find that in chapter 3 and verse 2. Amnon was the older of two sons and may well have been regarded as the heir apparent. Now, that's not said in the text. I don't think it's too speculative to say that that could very well be the situation, since he was the oldest, and often those things passed to the oldest son. Tamar was the daughter of David, and Maachah, the daughter of the king of Geshur, and we find that recorded in chapter 3 and verse 3 as well. Amnon is infatuated, can't call it love, even though the text uses that word, not love in the truest possible sense, could not love her. He didn't even know her. He looked at her from a distance. Tamar was beautiful to gaze upon, and Amnon was bewitched by her. In love, but love with a question mark, with her. Again, the same author that I cited moments ago, who preached a series of sermons on the text, and said or wrote, infatuation is a very all-consuming experience which many mistake for love. Clearly, there is a prohibition in the scriptures for what Amnon eventually did. Leviticus chapter 18, in verses 9, 11, and then chapter 20 in verse 17, speak of prohibitions against two sins that appear in the text. One is violating a woman, and the other is incest. And Amnon is guilty of both. I can't help but think of 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and again in chapter 11, and I've cited this before or referenced this before, but in both of those, there's language similar to this particular kind of sin, different there than it is here. But the language of those texts is not so much named as even among the Gentiles. Here are sins that are prohibited, condemned in God's law, but are of such a nature that even the Gentiles, even unbelievers historically, have rejected them and retreated from them and have been repelled by them. But not so Amnon. Here is the persistence of an unbridled, unnatural, and unlawful passion. It so gripped him that it made him ill, to the point of illness, the text tells us. He could do nothing to satisfy his passion, and he physically wasted away. The text begins by telling us that he was sick. And then later, when his friend and cousin speaks to him, he told him to feign illness. So both are true. He was sick, in view of his passion. Again, Gordon Keddy comments on the absence of real love. Keddy writes, "The ingredients of a general love are altogether lacking. There is no self-giving commitment, no seeking of the other's highest good, no sensitive devotion, not even a hint of romance. There was only naked physical lust and an utterly self-centered disregard for Tamar's personal integrity, welfare, and blessedness." And so, Amnon is guilty. But I submit to you that Amnon was guilty long before he actually committed the act. Remember the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5, where he looks at sin, at certain sins, not to the exclusion of others, but certain sins, and identifies certain sins and strips the hearer, his hearers, of the notion that sin is merely something of an external thing. You've heard it said, Jesus says, "Thou shalt not kill." But I say unto you that even if you're angry with a brother, you've committed the act already. And likewise with adultery. You've heard it said, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." But I say unto you, and he goes on to speak of the lusting of the heart. Where did Amnon's sin begin? It did not begin with the lie and the laying hold of her and all of that. It began with this persistent, unlawful passion that would not go away. Secondly, notice from the text not only the persistence of this unbridled passion, but the insistence of an ill-advised recommendation. The sinful counsel of Jonadab, an ill-advised orchestration so that Amnon might get what he truly wanted. Counsel from someone allegedly a friend and clearly a relative. The Puritan Joseph Hall wrote, "Perhaps yet this unkindly flame might in time have gone out alone, had not there been a Jonadab to blow these coals with ill counsel. It were strange if great princes should want some parasitical followers that are ready to feed their ill humors." And so you have the entry now in the text of a third person, a friend and a cousin. And he looks at him and scrutinizes him and he says, "Why, you're wasting away. Put it in modern terms, you've lost a lot of weight and your face looks pale and you don't look well at all. What's wrong with you?" And so Amnon tells him of his infatuation with his half-sister. Jonadab is referred to as someone who is wise. Now, we are not to think of wisdom here, even though it's the same word. We are not to think of wisdom in the same way that we think of, say, of the book of Proverbs, in which there is godly wisdom, a wisdom that leads to seeking the best ends to holy and righteous and godly goals, but a worldly wisdom, a cleverness, a cunning, And we discover that in the text. He plays on his cousin's illicit fantasy and shows him a wicked way forward. Jonadab is no real friend. We use that term in a number of different ways, do we not? We speak of friends, acquaintances, people that we might live next door to or down the street from and have some kind of a relationship to them. But a real friend, and the kind of friend that Christians need and require, are those who help us onto God and not draw us away or pull us away. And so we ought to be careful in the choice of friends. Even family members can lead us astray. I mean, this Jonadab was a cousin as well as a friend. And so we must conclude that in reality he was no real friend to Amnon. Gordon Ketty writes, "Clever or not, the Jonadabs of this world are not friends but enemies to those who aid and abet." Or Joseph Hall, reinforcing what I said just moments ago, "There cannot be a more worthy improvement of friendship than in a fervent opposition to the sins of them whom we profess to love." Now, David is inserted at this point as well, and it's a part of the cunning plan of Jonadab. David comes and he takes a look at his son and he sees the same thing that Jonadab does, but doesn't know the reason apparently why it is the case. And it is at this point that Amnon suggests that he send for his half-sister and for this half-sister to be a kind of nurse to him, to nurse him back to health. And so we need to draw the conclusion, and we'll see more of this later, that this is a part, or at least in part, David's collusion, unwittingly so perhaps, nevertheless, perhaps seeing something of David's indulgence at this point and at not being careful enough in inquiring as to what this was all about. Someone has written, "Who is less suspecting of children's wiles than parents, whose sympathies are more ready to cater to their every wish?" There are parents who find it impossible ever to say no. So we have, secondly, then, the insistence of an ill-advised, indeed wicked and sinful recommendation. And thirdly, we come to perhaps the most horrific part of the text, and that is the presence of depraved violation in verses 7 to 14. Now, it's interesting to observe how these verses unfold. The text is marked, first of all, by a humility. Tamar is a member of nobility, of royalty, and yet she's asked to perform a domestic task, something she certainly knew how to do. This wouldn't have been the first time she would have baked perhaps a particular kind of bread. Perhaps even some have suggested with certain kinds of herbs and such to assist in his alleged recovery. She's a member of royalty. She's a member of nobility. However, she's not above fulfilling what we might call womanly or domestic duties. Here was a woman that has much to commend her. She's obedient to her father, and she's willing to serve in something of a menial task far below her station. Richard Phillips comments on this, and I think rightly so. He says, "It is women like Tamar who are the very fabric of godly society. Women like her in the church, and girls growing up in her godly spirit, cultivating beauty, sexual purity, devotion to God, and a heart of good works and compassion." He concludes by saying, "These things are beyond price in their spiritual value." It's a text that's marked then by an appropriate godly devotion and humility. It's also marked a bit perhaps by gullibility. Perhaps she herself, in an unsuspecting way, not to blame her, certainly not in the least. But how many are captivated by stumbling into and falling into difficult or situations that end up badly? It's marked by modesty when she finally discovers what it is that Amnon wants. She says in verse 12, "Do not do this thing." She asserts a godly and a moral perspective. Tamar had spiritual depth. In fact, she speaks first of all in her response, in her response that's marked by clarity, drawing three conclusions. She says, first of all, this is not something that should occur at all in Israel. This is not in keeping with our calling as the people of God. Sinful and wicked as it is anyway, it's not in keeping with our calling as the people of God. It's not in keeping with the holiness of Israel. Her first argument was for the reputation of the people of God. You might say for the reputation of the church. This is unbecoming the people of God. The moral law addresses us in that way. Secondly, she says that if you do this, it will bring shame upon me. That is shame upon her. Here is sinfulness. Here is shamefulness. And here is scornfulness for you. You will be considered one of the fools, the Nabals of the community. You will prove yourself to be and demonstrate yourself to be a wicked pervert, a godless wretch, and immoral. Well, of course, we know that the text is also marked by depravity. He would not listen. Desire drove him at all cost, at the costs that have been or were mentioned. And then he kicks her out. Manhandled again, Davis writes, and dumped outside. She makes an interesting comment at this point. She says, "Stop. And then she says, talk to the king. Perhaps he will give me to you as your wife. Now, I don't think the text necessarily suggests that that would be her desire, but perhaps more that it's a delay tactic and she's buying for time. And it doesn't work. And so here is a text that is also marked by melancholy and distress. She tears in two her virginal robe. Apparently, it was customary for the king's daughters, unmarried, to wear a particularly colorful robe. And with the loss of her virginity and her reputation, or the loss of her virginity in this way and her reputation, she tears in a very public way, or rather that she appears now in a very public way. As one who has been stripped of her glory. Fourthly, notice the consequence of a calculated transgression in verses 15 through 22. Notice, first of all, the insolence of Amnon. I've already mentioned that. He dismisses her unceremoniously. He disregarded her. Keddie writes, this is always the case when sexual desire jumps the rails of God's plan for personal sexual fulfillment. From alleged affection to insolence and rejection. Secondly, notice the insistence of Tamar. Actions have consequences, and I've already made reference to them. And so Amnon responds, Tamar responds. But we know thirdly as well what we might call the indifference of David. David hears what has happened and he becomes angry, but notice he does nothing more. He does nothing to relieve the situation. He does nothing to defend his daughter. He does nothing to punish Amnon. And remember, not only was he a father in the context, but he was also the chief magistrate of the kingdom. And it would have been his responsibility to impose, even upon his own family, the punishments and the penalties of sins committed. There is resentment, but no resolution. Here is clearly indulgence, the indulgence of a parent, the indulgence of an unwarranted compassion, or at least a weakness. In neither case, with regard to Tamar or to Amnon, is justice served. And then fourthly and finally, the influence of Absalom. So four main characters, and of course we have Jonadab as well, but four main characters. And David tells his sister to do nothing. On the surface, it seems cruel, and perhaps it was. But Absalom is merely buying his time, as the text clearly indicates. 2 years pass before he does anything, And then he orchestrates the death of his half-brother. The indulgence, fifthly and finally then, the indulgence of an unwarranted retribution. Here is the wrong way to bring about alleged justice. He has a design. He waits for 2 years. The design is calculated. A design is conceived. He'll host a celebration and a fair around the sheep shearing time of year and invite the king and invite all of the king's sons. Seeking to manipulate his father, who for whatever reason, well, actually the reason is given, doesn't want to be a burden to his son. At least that's the answer that's given. Absalom continues, and finally he executes through his servants his design. Gordon Keddy writes, and I think rightly so, he planned to repay Amnon's breach of the seventh commandment with his own breach of the sixth. Sins committed one after another. Responses one after another. But no justice. Matthew Henry writes, here we learn the malignity of sin and the mischievous consequences of sin. Well, very quickly, I want to leave you with three things, perhaps maybe even a fourth. First of all, notice that David is a key figure, even though others appear prominent in the text. David had sinned. His sin bore consequences for himself and his son through Bathsheba. But as the chapter unfolds here, David shows himself to be permissive and passive, and thus responsibly, or rather, and thus not preventative in responsibility. David is partially responsible for these failures, not to take away from the sinfulness of Amnon, his cousin and friend, and eventually Absalom as well. David remains the key figure as the magistrate, but also as a father. Right family discipline consists in enforcing God's law. Indulgence leads to decadence, to disobedience, and in the context, to death itself, death itself. David sinned, and his family sinned, and they too suffered. Corruption has consequences. Corruption has consequences. Now, the second thing to observe from our text is that God's prophetic word always comes true. God told David through the prophet that his house would suffer for the sins that he had committed, and especially what is targeted in chapter 12 is the murder of Uriah the Hittite. God fulfills his word of judgment. We're thankful that God fulfills his words of grace and his words of mercy. And so many of us have received that, but God fulfills his word of judgment as well. God fulfills his promise of chastisement, which is not eternal punishment, but certainly chastisement for his people as well. Sin brings consequences. One of the interesting things about this text is that God is never mentioned. We saw this earlier in 2 Samuel chapter 1, on the occasion of Saul's death. God was not mentioned. God is not mentioned. God is absent, and when God is absent, and where God is absent, this is how things tend to unfold. And thirdly and finally, remember that as to office, in terms of the Davidic covenant, as to office, David foreshadows the Messianic king. Our king has triumphed, but not in the Davidic way. This particular text does not point us to Jesus as the Davidic covenant would ordinarily do. David foreshadows certain things, but not in a flattering way. This is not David at his best, but his greater son is always at his best. David, human, sinful as he was, brought destruction upon himself and his own house. And in many ways, from here on, so much of his life is downhill, even with his own life being threatened by family members. This is not David at his best. But his greater son is always at his best. We may think as well of Tamar's virginal robe, this beautiful colored robe marking her and identifying her in a unique and holy and pristine way, now torn. And yet there is another robe that is not torn, and that is the robe, the white robe, the righteous robe of the Lord Jesus Christ, with which he robes his sons and daughters. And so we see a text. We study a text. We're disappointed in so much of what this text teaches. But all that must do, needs to do, is to point us in the direction of the correction and the resolution of the kinds of things that we find here in our text. And once again, seeing something of the peerless perfection, perfect robing by the Lord Jesus Christ of his own dear children. Let us pray.